This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. We continue exploring the political and social aspects of habits and addictions. Professor Ed Miller informs us about the political angle.
A lot of it's related to poverty in the United States, and poverty in the United States is not going down.
Professor Bob Walensky offers some insight into how different cultures encourage or discourage habits.
Culture is extremely important in understanding addictions.
Yoga practitioner Akhilesh Brahmachari shares with us his experience of being addicted to chai.
Usually I have not so far heard that anybody saying that I don't want to have a tea.
First, some medical news. The World Health Organization announced that Somalia is once again polio-free. This landmark achievement has occurred due to the efforts of 10,000 Somali volunteers and health workers who repeatedly vaccinated nearly 2 million children. Somalia has been dealing with widespread conflict, large population shifts, and poor government infrastructure, and is rated one of the most dangerous places on earth. Somalia's last case of indigenous polio was in 2002. The country was reinfected by poliovirus originating in Nigeria in July 2005. This resulted in an outbreak of 228 cases. Systematic and wide-scale outbreak response activities, including intensive community engagement, successfully stopped the epidemic, and the last case was reported on the 25th of March 2007. We must remember the biggest risk factors for polio remain poverty and lack of clean water. At a celebration of International Women's Day, director of the Pan-American Health Organization, Dr. Mirta Rosas, emphasized that gender inequality is completely unacceptable. She stated that gender inequality is directly responsible for the high maternal mortality rates, domestic violence, and the growing incidence of HIV among girls and women in Latin America and the Caribbean. Two awards were offered to projects in Bolivia and Mexico that were based on best practices incorporating a gender equality perspective in health. The project from Bolivia was honored for its successful efforts in reducing maternal and infant mortality in a heavily indigenous area. The second winner was a program by Mexico's Ministry of Health, which used a gender perspective to determine differences in diabetes rates and risk factors among women and men in Mexico, and developed separate interventions with those differences in mind. From the International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Health, less than 10% of the world's electronic equipment waste, known as e-waste, is recycled. E-waste includes old computers, cell phones, monitors, televisions. The U.S. and other developed nations export most of their e-waste to Asia. E-waste is harmful to the poor communities where it is discarded. The European Union banned the use of lead, mercury, cadmium, hexavalent chromium, and certain brominated flame retardants in electronic equipment since 2006. This is requiring manufacturers to develop products that are safer and easier to make, repair, upgrade, and recycle. However, this directive only applies regionally and covers only a fraction of the toxic substances used and products manufactured. Given the toxicity to workers manufacturing electronics and the communities who suffer from receiving the toxic waste at the end of life of the products, there is an urgent need for manufacturers to develop clean products with longer lifespans that are not hazardous to workers and the environment. The current issue of Cerebral Cortex reports on a study from the University of Bonn that supports the hypothesis that running does elicit a flood of endorphins in the brain that offers the runner a natural high. The research team, led by Dr. Becker, used PET scans to compare the amount and location of endorphins, a natural morphine-like chemical produced by the body, before and after a 2-hour run. The runners also took a standardized psychological test that assessed mood changes. The study showed an increased amount of endorphins in the areas of the brain related to mood, the limbic and prefrontal areas, after a long run. New research by the Department of Health and Human Services indicates that though, on the whole, people in the USA are living longer, the greatest gains in life expectancy are among the affluent. The widening gap in life expectancy between the rich and the poor is also seen in infant mortality, cancer mortality, and deaths from heart disease. The life expectancy difference between poor black men and affluent white women was between 10 to 14 years. Several hypotheses might explain the widening gap. Affluent people are more likely to take advantage of early detection technologies for heart disease and cancer. Poor people tend to live in unsafe neighborhoods and to engage in risky behaviors and to eat unhealthy food. A majority of the people who do not have health insurance in the U.S. are likely to be lower income. Without health insurance, they are unlikely to seek medical care in a timely manner. Professor Edward Miller is co-director of the Center for the Small City at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. He is a Eugene Katz Letters and Science Distinguished Faculty Member in the Department of Political Science. I spoke with him in his office in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, USA. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for talking to me today about the politics of habits and addictions. Most of us think of habits and addictions as an individual's problem. We often forget that this problem is occurring in the context of society. Part of that is the availability of drugs and the politics around which drugs are available and to whom. So I wondered if you could talk to us about that.
There's a tremendous desire for drugs in the United States. There's an increasing addiction problem in the United States. And consequently, the United States has two ways of doing it. One, we try to interdict the drugs coming into the United States, as well as to reduce the supply in the home countries. And we have not been very successful in Afghanistan. We have done it through Latin America in a number of cases as well. The other way is to try to get people off of drugs in the United States and reduce demand. The second aspect of drugs, which is becoming even more prominent in the United States, and that is the underground, essentially, marketing of pharmaceuticals. Many of these drugs are coming from physicians, in which individuals go into physicians' emergency rooms and they get various drugs, and then those drugs are then sold, and drugs such as Vicodin bring a hefty sum on the market. Because physicians are in a very difficult situation, even physicians that are pretty legitimate. Somebody comes in, they have this particular problem, and they don't know that person had been to 3 or 4 other emergency rooms or something like that. There's a need to deal with some people's pain, particularly people who have severe pain. On the other hand, there's a need to reduce addictions and reduce the amount.
I face this a lot in my own practice. I work in an urgent care, and we have a certain proportion of patients that tell us that they have pain, and it's difficult for us to know whether they're actually having pain or whether they're just seeking a prescription which they can then sell on the market.
Right, and this is a problem not only in larger communities like San Francisco, but is also a problem in smaller communities such as Portage County. As a matter of fact, a former student of mine is the drug officer for the Sheriff's Department in Portage County. He was telling me he went into one of the physician's offices in Stevens Point. Physicians suspected that that patient was seeking drugs, and so he came in to deal with the situation because the patient would not leave. But when he walked into the waiting room, he saw 3 or 4 other people sitting in the waiting room that were under suspicion for doing that. And that, you know, indicates if it's happening in a smaller community like Portage County, it's happening, obviously, all over the country in larger communities. And the illegal drug market, drugs coming into this country, it's very, very difficult to stem that tide. They're very, very valuable. And this is one of the reasons that some people, such as former Mayor Schmuck, who got sort of heat for this, he was former mayor of Baltimore, had recommended that drugs not be made illegal, to decriminalize this, essentially, and making the treatment of drugs more like, I think, in England, where it's more of a medical problem. And the idea here was not necessarily would get people off of drugs more, maybe it would, but it would break the connection to some extent between crime and drugs. So here we have two problems when we could have, you know, we could reduce one of the problems. And the fact is he was the state's attorney, and he came under tremendous heat for this sort of off-the-wall suggestion, which was perceived to, because we have to be very tough on drugs. But, you know, our tough on drugs seemed not to be getting very far.
Can you tell us about how the war on drug, how it's being waged, and what are the policies?
Well, there's a national office on drugs that we have. It's the so-called drug czar, which we've had for, I don't know, maybe up to 20 years. And so there's money that comes out of that office to up drug efforts. And so in each of the communities, you have drug officers, you have drug task force, and things like that to try to pinpoint the drugs and do the police work. Often, they don't arrest as much far less users of the drug. They're more interested in really the distributors of the drugs. So in many communities, I'm aware that they use the users of the drugs as a, you know, a way of trying to get information who the distributors are. On the other end of it, we're trying to beef up certainly treatment. It's very, very difficult to get people off of drugs. Once you get on drugs, it's a very powerful force.
You talked about the targeting of the domestic suppliers as one part of the war on drugs. Can you speak a little bit about what's happening on the international scene?
Well, on the international scene, we are putting pressure on certain countries, Colombia, for example, and South America in particular, Afghanistan is another one, to try to deal with the drug problem in their country in terms of the drugs coming in. One of the big problems in these countries has to do with the agricultural production. The production of drugs and poppies and so forth are very lucrative, and so even the farmers want to go off of these drugs and, I mean, not produce these drugs, or what are they going to produce? And so some of our efforts is to try to change the economics of the situation, and so the farmers could grow other things other than these drugs. The other thing that we have done is, in some of these countries, we have put pesticides on these fields that are growing these drugs to try to essentially destroy the crop. It's all connected to the political situations of the country. And so you have lots of politicians, for example, who are involved in the money end of the drug trade. And so there's political support for these individuals. It's very, very difficult for the existing government to deal with this situation, and especially in countries that have vast poverty. So these individuals who are drawing the drugs and related to the drug trade are not only profiting, but, you know, they're living well. And then you have a whole bunch of the other country that is not involved in the drug trade. They're in dire poverty. So this kind of inequality is a very difficult thing to deal with.
Would governments have a disincentive to stemming the production of drug crops, because then those farmers would then essentially join the poverty class, and then they'd have a bigger population that the government has to deal with to bring out of poverty?
Right. I think they do have a disincentive, not only in terms of the poverty, but also in terms of the political support that is in that area of richer farmers, in which money is then coming to the government itself. Where the United States deals with this situation is primarily through aid. And the fact is that we're giving money to these countries, and we're using that aid basically as a leverage to demand that the countries be involved in this drug abatement program. And, you know, some years it does well, but overall it has not done extraordinarily well. It's very difficult because these governments really don't control large areas of the country. I mean, you know, so even if they wanted to do something, take Afghanistan, which may be an extreme example, the government really only controls part of that country. I mean, a lot of the country is controlled by tribal leaders or Taliban. You know, and they keep talking about anti-drugs, getting the poppy, you know, trade down or whatever, and we have a bumper crop this year.
And it sounds like also the governments are actually benefiting on both ends. They're getting aid from the United States government, and they're getting support from the farmers.
Well, they are. Even if the government itself, the top of the government, you know, maybe not be profiting in some cases, there are different levels of this government. And so once you get down to the district level, I'm quite sure that many of them are receiving some money from the growers.
The U.S. government got a lot of criticism from certain parts of our own society for doing this mass spraying of pesticides over fields without a regard to the people living in the fields or the other crops that may have been growing nearby.
Right, and that's a major problem. I mean, we have in other words, it does hurt the people. There's an environmental issue there in one case. And the other thing is that some of these drugs, even though they've been sprayed, come into the United States. And so individuals who are using these drugs, you know, are using drugs that have been sprayed with pesticides. And so, in effect, they are getting the negative aspects of our policy. The spraying of the crops has been an issue. Any kinds of crops that we have done, you know, Vietnam, you know, the results of Agent Orange and so forth, we have that end of it. But also the fact is that this is affecting the drugs coming in the United States. And you could say, well, it makes the drugs bad, well, and not usable. Well, that would be good. The United States would look at them. But in fact, they are being used. And as a result, individuals are suffering the consequences.
So there's the production end of it generally happening overseas.
Right. The production end is basically happening overseas. We also are hoping that they arrest individuals in these cartels. Again, it's very difficult to do because they're very politically strong and dangerous. I mean, they go out and they, you know, mass murder, you know, they've killed quite a number of people. And you hear this all the time, both in Mexico and Colombia and so forth. So it's pretty dangerous overseas in that area. And in the United States, it's more of a law enforcement effort.
And so then there's the issue of once those drugs are produced overseas, how are they getting in?
Oh, well, they're being smuggled into the United States, which is, you know, despite our efforts on 9/11 and various efforts, smuggling stuff in the United States is not overwhelmingly difficult for these individuals. They seem to be getting in. It's very difficult for us to inspect. We do pick up things every once in a while. You see this huge shipments or something like that that is picked up by our border agents. But a lot of the stuff is coming in various ways that we don't inspect. There's no indication that there's been a major stemming of the flow, even though we've upped our border effort. Supply in the United States is quite clearly has not dried up.
Why do you think that the demand is so high in the United States compared to other countries?
Drug demand is high. People begin using drugs recreationally. And then once you begin using these drugs and you say, oh, I'm going to do it once, you know, with cocaine or something like that, you're at a party, and then you're hooked to the drugs. In terms of the individuals in poverty, probably drugs are ways of getting out of the terrible situation that they find themselves in. You can look at not only drugs, the strangest thing is cigarettes. And we've been increasing the price of cigarettes through taxes and so forth. And you would think that, gee whiz, you know, that this would stop people who are poor from purchasing cigarettes because the price is now so high for cigarettes. But if you look at cigarette consumption in the United States, it's very heavily among people in poverty, as well as people who have mental problems. Those are the people who can't afford it. So in effect, the tax that we're putting in to try to reduce consumption is really a regressive tax. But if you go to inner cities, you find far more people smoking than you would, for example, I mean, just on, you know, without a survey, just going into a more affluent area. People are still smoking, which is interesting given all the information we have. But still, the proportionally smoking is less than you will find in inner city areas.
How do you think the legality of a drug influences its use?
Oh, I think the legality may increase its use. I mean, because people say that with cigarettes. People will say, gee, you know, well, we have rights. Smokers have rights, you know, kind of thing. Well, you have a right to get lung cancer and things like that and give it to other people if secondhand smoke. But it's a legal drug. And so legal drugs are considered more acceptable. But I think there's a cultural aspect which overrides the legality of it. And certainly other drugs are illegal. So I think that with regard to the full drug market, there is the legality, semi-legality, and the legality. You know, once you're hooked on, you know, some of these major drugs, I don't know if many of the people are really thinking about the illegality of these drugs when they obtain them. Also, the other thing is, as with all crime, I think the people who obtain these drugs in particular don't think they're going to get caught. I mean, because, you know, people robbing a bank don't think they're going to get caught, or they wouldn't rob a bank, probably. I mean, you know, unless they like the facilities of the jail, you know. And in fact, most users don't get caught. Drug dealers have a little bit more of a risk.
Why do you think the U.S. government is so interested in reducing drug use and drug trade in America?
It's an interesting question. I'm not a sociologist. It could come back from the Puritan nature of the country. I mean, we banned alcohol, certainly, in the early 20th century. And so there's a feeling that drugs are bad. It's a question of what should government do? And some people don't think that government should regulate the drugs. Some people are very libertarian and say, well, you know, if you want to use the drugs on your own body, you should be able to use the drugs on your own body. Obviously, government is interested in illegality situation like robbery or something to get money for the drugs. But in terms of using the drugs, some people believe, well, it's an individual choice, while other people believe that society has an effort to get rid of substances that can affect judgment and other things like that, and that we have this idea of regulating what can be done and what is the authority, what is the rights of government. So it deals with all the way from more interventionist individuals who feel that all drugs should be banned, including cigarettes, versus other individuals who believe that the society should take a much more libertarian and just do what is absolutely necessary, and this isn't absolutely necessary, except when drugs are related to crime.
And that's where taking the legality issue out of it by making drugs legal, you would essentially take the criminal aspect out of it.
Right, and that's the idea, and that was Schmoke's idea, the idea that a lot of the problems that we're having with drugs, particularly in cities, deal with the crime which stems from the drugs, and also its reduction in supply. And so if you have a lesser supply, the price goes up. And if the price goes up, then you need more money to purchase the drugs. Drugs that you can buy over the counter, which are cheaper, some of which have very powerful effects. You don't find people sticking up stores to to get aspirin or things like that.
You know, we generally associate drug use with urban environments. But as you mentioned, it's also becoming common in smaller places throughout America. I'd like to get your perspective on urbanization and drug use. And as the world's population is moving more and more towards urban living, how that might influence drug use patterns.
Well, you seem to have more drug use in urban areas, and I think that there's probably a number of things. One is just simply the number of people living there. And you get more people, you're going to get everything. But the other thing is you have more concentrated poverty. Not necessarily more poverty, because they have as much poverty in rural areas as they have in urban areas. It's probably a little known fact. People always associate poverty with large cities, but in terms of percentage of poverty, there's a lot of poverty in small towns and rural areas. But when you have concentrated poverty, you have greater pressure. And when there's this greater pressure, there's greater interaction among the poor. There's a desire to ameliorate that condition. And drugs are one aspect to ameliorate that condition. You also have more availability of the drugs in the urban areas, simply because the urban area would be a point in which the drugs would come in. And so it's easier to get the drugs in those areas than some of the rural areas, which is less supply in anything. You know, if it's, you know, suppliers of the drugs will find it more lucrative in urban areas simply because there's more demanders of the drugs, simply because there's more people. So you have lesser ability to get the drugs in some of the rural areas, but they do, certainly, and we know the problem doesn't exist just in urban areas.
Anything else you could add about the politics of drugs?
U.S. needs to reconsider its approaches. I mean, we've put some money into this area and all that, but there needs to be some more innovative approaches to the area of drugs. And quite clearly, there's no question that a core problem is poverty. Whether you're talking about juvenile delinquency or drugs and all that, a lot of it's related to poverty in the United States, and poverty in the United States is not going down. It's quite clearly, it's going up. Reducing poverty would help a lot. So there's a core area, but it's one that is very, very difficult to deal with. So what you do is called the boundary issue. You know, you take the drug issue, you take the juvenile delinquency issue or whatever, or education issue, and you try to deal with that. Look at education, in the inner city. A lot of the problems of education in inner city relates to the poverty, necessarily poor teaching or anything like that.
And the elite probably are even higher risk.
Well, yeah, you have this higher risk there because they probably think they're immune.
And they can afford it.
And they have access to physicians. So they come into the physician and say, I can't sleep or, my back hurts or whatever. So they're not buying it in the alleys, but the physician is giving them a prescription.
Do you have any innovative suggestions for the U.S. government on how to address the drug issue? And would you have any interesting ideas on how we could tackle poverty?
No, not really. Not really. In terms of poverty, for one thing, is we need to cover everybody in healthcare to have a national health insurance system. We need to create more jobs. I think that, some decriminalization of drugs may be one avenue we should try. The broader issue of dealing with the culture of drugs is a very difficult one to change, and I'll leave that to sociologists.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. It's been really enjoyable talking to you.
You're welcome.
Professor Edward Miller, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point.
தென் தென் நகைத்து தென் கிரணங்க தறிக்கிட்டு தகத்தா தறிக்கிட்டு தெரு தெருக்கிட்டு தக்க தக்க தத்து கிரா கிரா தென் தென் தி நா தி நா
Dr. Robert Walensky is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. He is co-director of the Center for the Small City. I spoke with him in his office in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, USA. Dr. Walensky, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today.
Good to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about how cultures and society encourage or discourage habits and addictions?
I want to begin with the premise that we are not just individuals. This is with a fundamental sociological premise, that we are individuals. This is true, but it's not the whole truth. We're individuals who live and cope and have problems with and deal with social environments. Now, this seems obvious and very fundamental, but it's often forgotten in various kinds of therapies and various kinds of diagnoses and various kinds of orientations to social problems as well as individual problems. Yes, we're individuals, but we're individuals born with a genetic predisposition and a genetic profile, of course, but we're individuals furthermore born into families and communities and cultures, and this makes all the difference.
So what you're saying, that habits and addictions are individual problems, but they're also social problems.
Yes, that was my preface to that very point, that while an individual may have an addiction, that addiction could have and often does have a genetic component to it and an environmental component to it. Indeed, AA will tell you that alcoholism is a disease and that you don't choose to have this disease. It is something that you're quite frankly just born with. Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But certainly being in a certain kind of an environment, if you're in a culture where drinking to excess is considered standard and normal, obviously you're going to be influenced by that culture. When I visited Eastern Europe about 10 years ago with some students, I was just struck by the fact that every home I went into, mainly professional people's homes, had a still, a little vodka-making device in the kitchen under the table or in the living room in the corner, because you made your own vodka. This was a standard procedure. Not only did you make your own vodka, but when you had parties and when you had dinners, the norm was to drink virtually to your drunk, and it was almost unsocial or not very sociable to stop it after only one glass of vodka. Is something wrong? Aren't we being good hosts? Because the norms have been established in 1999. Men and women would more often than not drink to excess. This would be in Poland and Ukraine and in Hungary and a few other places. So culture is extremely important in understanding addictions. It's a huge share of the equation. Yes, you might be born with a predisposition to this, but the culture helps actualize this. I would think that if you had a predisposition to alcoholism, but if you were born among, you know, the Amish in this society who do not engage in alcohol, then you would not have any way to actualize that predisposition. On the other hand, take Italy as a country. Very little alcoholism in Italy. They have homebrew too, wine, in many, many cases, and there's wine all over the place. But the culture defines the use of wine in a social sense with meals. You rarely see public drunkenness in Italy. You rarely see drunkenness in Italy because the culture mitigates and defines how this beverage will be consumed.
How do societies actually set up these norms or promote these norms, or how do these norms come about?
Well, these norms evolve over time, long periods of time. powerful individuals can set standards, kings, queens in history. Certain physical aspects can shape some of these sorts of things. I think of the Eastern European societies formerly under the rule of the Soviet Union, where the stress was tremendous, where scarcity was always a problem, where fear of political problems was a problem. And so, given the tradition and the availability of vodka, especially in alcohol, of very strong spirits, you have a combination of stresses going even before the Soviet time. You know, the terrible situations in Imperial Russia with droughts and famines and exploitation. These large historical kinds of crises can begin to shape norms, and gradually it evolves into where it becomes the standard. Go to Muslim countries and you don't find the alcohol abuse because of religious leaders, secular leaders have not encouraged that. So it's not a simple question, but all I can say is that if you study a society carefully, you can see where certain events or certain individuals, certain traumas, certain crises, certain standards evolved and became the norm.
Do you think that sometimes, like for example, in Muslim countries, although the alcoholism isn't visible, it's just underground or covert?
That is certainly true in the more modern world and situation. The power of the media, the relative cheapness of alcohol, the fact that it's a social thing. Who would ever have a party, you know, without some alcohol? It lubricates things. This is now virtually a worldwide beverage, and it does go underground, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are here and there an alcoholic Amishman who has a vodka bottle in the, you know, in the barn or something. So it's pervasive, but it does vary greatly from culture to culture. In a society like the United States, where alcohol is extremely available, where we have a very fast-paced life, where advertising makes it very acceptable, where it's cheap, given especially our standard of living. If one has a genetic propensity to this, it's going to be very hard not to just walk into that. Very, very hard.
So if we take the example of alcohol and look at other substances or other habits, say tobacco, and maybe we can make an analogy between a king and the Californian government and how the ban on tobacco use in public places has really changed the culture of tobacco use and the acceptability of smoking in California. And it's quite noticeable if you just travel to other parts of the United States how differently smokers are viewed.
Yeah, well, we're talking in Wisconsin, and our governor just referred to Wisconsin as the ashtray of the Midwest because our surrounding states, at least most of the surrounding states, have outlawed tobacco use, and we just turned it down again in our legislature. One house passed it, one house would not, because of the power of the tavern lobby. And I'm sure the tobacco interests are in there too. But that's a good example how a law, we mentioned a trauma, a king, you know, an important event, a war, can set a standard that we have outlawed tobacco in many places, or else we have raised the tax to astronomical levels. Some Scandinavian countries have done this. And it does greatly reduce use, and certainly improves health. We tried this, however, with alcohol in 1919, 1920 in this country, and it did not work. I think what that shows is that you can't outlaw tobacco because organized crime will just provide the product because enough people will want it. But you can restrict its use, and that's been our approach with alcohol, too. In the U.S., you can't drink, you know, unless you're 21, a controversial issue. And we have certain hours, varies by state to state. In many Wisconsin towns, you can't buy alcohol in a grocery market after 9 o'clock in the evening. In some states, you can't buy alcohol in any supermarket because the state stores control it. Only the state of Pennsylvania can sell you hard liquor and wine, although beer can be bought in what they call beer distributors or in only by the six-pack in taverns. Taverns cannot sell cases of beer. But laws to restrict can definitely have profound effects in establishing norms. Some European countries allow alcohol drinking at age 16. Two views on that. One is it leads to a lot of early abuse. The other view is that we teach people how to drink since it's legal. Furthermore, it doesn't erode support for the law in general, as in the U.S., all of our 18 and 19-year-olds, I mean, the great majority of them drink. And so does this undermine respect for the law?
Right. And there's also a way in which that person is viewed as performing criminal activity or illegal activity. That person gets a different self-image.
Well, yeah, if you can drink illegally and get away with it, maybe you can speed illegally and get... You have the danger of creating a new norm. Sociologists like to talk about emergent norms that come from circumstances and then become fairly standardized. And that emergent norm with regard to deviance could be it's only illegal if you get caught. So you can speed and you can cheat on your income taxes and you can work for cash and you can drink illegally and you can steal, but it's only illegal if you get caught. And when you have that, you have a formula for very widespread deviance.
One of the things that I have always found very interesting is the fact that, take two neighboring states, Minnesota and Wisconsin, and their cultural roots are somewhat different in that Wisconsin is predominantly Polish and German heritage, correct? And Minnesota is more Scandinavian. And when we compare the amount of alcohol used in Wisconsin and Minnesota, actually the amount of alcohol used in Wisconsin is much greater than in Minnesota. But when we compare the rates of alcoholism, as defined medically, that the rates are much higher in Minnesota. There must be some cultural difference in how that alcohol is being used.
Yeah, it could be, first of all, a matter of how we define alcoholism. Wisconsin's a very heavily working class state. Milwaukee, a major manufacturing center in its heyday. Of course, Milwaukee area has lost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs in the last 30 years. But the working class traditionally defines alcoholism as the inability to perform your job.
Yes, it's a functional definition.
It's a functional definition. Whereas Minnesota, a more affluent state and a more middle-class state, might define alcoholism more clinically than functionally. So when you say alcoholism is higher in Minnesota, my first thought is I'd like to see how the different definitions might figure into those statistics. Wisconsin has a large number of Scandinavians as well, but I don't think it's as high a proportion as it is in Minnesota. Both states have considerable other groups. I mean, we can't forget the French and the English and the Scottish and the Irish and Native Americans. There's, of course, a lot of other smatterings of a lot of other groups, but Wisconsin is the most German state in the Union. About a third of Wisconsinites or so identify with German background. And Polish is also a very large, high number in Wisconsin. Both Polish and Germanic, even Scandinavian societies, but especially the first two, do have an emphasis on alcohol consumption. The German breweries of Wisconsin, the Schlitz, the Blatz, the Miller, the Pabst, Heilemann over in La Crosse. This was once the major brewing state, and we've lost most of those breweries by now. We have a number of microbrews, but drinking culture is very strong in Wisconsin. I'm not exactly sure why Wisconsin would have a lower number of alcoholics compared to Minnesota, because by the same token, perhaps there's a situation where those cultures also learn to deal with alcohol consumption in social situations. So perhaps that's the mitigating factor. Whereas perhaps in Minnesota, and I don't know a great deal about this issue when it comes to Minnesota, maybe the definition was to deal with the alcohol in an excessive situation. But my suspicion is that the difference may be a matter of defining alcoholism.
But I also think it might be exactly what you're saying, is how the alcohol is used in the context of your life. Like if you're drinking in private, alone, or if you're drinking to deal with repressed emotions, or if you're drinking in a social situation as a method of socializing.
Keep in mind that Wisconsin is a very heavily Lutheran state, and so is Minnesota. German Lutherans and Scandinavian Lutherans are prevalent in Wisconsin, and Minnesota has a large number of Scandinavian Lutherans. At least the stereotype of the Scandinavian Lutheran is very introspective and very private. Could this lead to some kind of more privatized drinking as opposed to the more social drinking of the Polish culture or of the German Catholics, who are also very prevalent in Wisconsin? So it could be, but I'm quite frankly not knowledgeable enough to make any kind of a definitive statement about that.
How does this conversation translate to other substances, heroin, cocaine, marijuana?
Well, look at youth culture. The popular culture as it relates to youth is very much what one sociologist called the sensate culture, where sensuality, pleasure, and immediate gratification, reinforced by advertising, reinforced by television, reinforced by the popular culture. And then we have new cheap drugs coming out now, like cheese, which is a very addictive form of heroin. One of my own relatives was 18 when she overdosed on heroin. Got caught up in a youth subculture, had the money because she was upper middle class, went into therapy and counseling after a few close calls, and finally overdosed and died. And it was a great tragedy for the family. But the opportunities are there. The immaturity of many youth are there. The social pressures are there. And this is an easy feeding ground for organized crime and other folks who want to push their products. I should also add, with the deindustrialization and the economic shift in our society, globalization and the growth of service jobs and free trade, we have decimated the labor markets in many of our larger cities. The best jobs in town are drug dealing. We have been the creator of many of our own social problems when it comes to other substances like drugs. And I see we're now the number one cause for being in federal penitentiaries is drug dealing. We've set a lot of the table because we've reorganized the society's economy over the past 30 years. It's been called globalization for short. We have not looked to the social consequences of any of this reorganization. I say Milwaukee has lost probably up to 100,000 manufacturing jobs. We've replaced them with service jobs. We have many more jobs than we've lost, but those jobs don't pay as well. Much of the service economy does not provide benefits. When I taught at the Oxford Federal Penitentiary in Wisconsin for 10 years, this university, the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, where we're speaking from, had a program at Oxford Penitentiary, which is a federal pen about 30 miles south of here. And I had many people in there who were drug dealers 15 years ago, and they would tell me point blank, I was not going to work in effect the new service economy, fast food. I was just not going to do it. Didn't pay. I was not going to demean myself. I was treated like a dog. I was going to deal drugs. It was the best job around. And this guy's father had worked in a steel mill, but those steel mill jobs are gone, long, long, long gone. So we haven't looked into the repercussions, the multidimensional repercussions of our blind faith and belief in economic development. That's the mantra of the day. It's the national religion in many ways is economic growth, wealth, income, sprawl related to this. We have not paid attention to how economic development can undermine social development.
I would say that that's a global religion.
It is a global religion, absolutely.
Even in Dharamsala, India, the best job in town is drug dealing.
The left hand doesn't know what the right hand doing. This blind faith in the market, trust the market and all will be well. You know, if anything that we were taught by the 19th century was that if you trust the market, all you're going to get is recessions and depressions and gross inequality and gross exploitation. The market must be guided for social purposes. And I think we'll discover that sometime in the early part of the 21st century, but the last 30 years has been one gigantic binge of market expansion.
Can you talk a little bit about social pressures, how different cultures pressure people to use?
Well, advertising works. Youth culture is part of this. The adults, let's not forget the adults, many of whom have bored, meaningless lives, and the way you fill a bored, meaningless life is to use substances. It is quite a crisis of postmodernism, finding meaning and purpose in life. Spiritualities have been very underdeveloped. We don't know our pasts, so we don't know where we came from because we're always madly rushing toward the future. We were not even happy in the present, are we? You know, we're maximizing our output, maximizing our profits. We have a whole personality, which is a market-driven personality, to attain success, and that success is running to the future. So at all times, we're checking our watches because we have to be somewhere else, and that somewhere else is in the future. That is often fueled by caffeine, by nicotine, by alcohol, and by harder drugs. Amphetamines in my youth were the very popular drug to help you keep up with that rat race. So this is one of the crises of postmodern world, how to find some kind of inner peace, inner meaning, some kind of historic sensibility, some kind of broader connection with humanity, and broader purposes, which you can define broadly as some kind of spirituality. It could be organized religion, or it could be some other kind of meaningfulness that you don't get from the popular culture, from mass consumption. This is all about profit making. This is all about market development. It produces people who can be quite hollow if they really submerge themselves, as many, many or most do, in that culture.
And they feel hollow.
And they feel hollow.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I wish we had more time because it's a very fascinating subject. The medical community, as they do their diagnoses and as they deal with people, I think have to realize that there are these bigger issues involved. We are individuals with individual problems, but we're also individuals in social circumstances, which I think in the postmodern world are becoming more dire as families become weaker, as communities become weaker, as jobs become more insecure, as the pressures for consumption mount, especially about young folks, need to get a greater bearing. So many of the anxiety disorders, so-called, that we treat with antidepressants, people need antidepressants, but they also somehow need to address these fundamental underlying issues, which physicians, of course, can't do themselves, but at least ought to be aware of. I think the answers to these problems and questions are fundamentally political and are fundamentally social. The paradigms and the models on how to get from here to there, I think, are out there. There are many societies that are doing a much better job dealing with the social disintegration than the U.S. is. So we have a lot of problems that result from our very low level of social development in the United States. But
thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and it's been very, very interesting and informative.
Thank you very much.
Professor Robert Walensky from the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Mr. Akhilesh Brahmachari is a yoga practitioner and teacher. He teaches workshops in Goa, Rishikesh, different parts of Europe, and in Hong Kong. I spoke with him after a yoga class we took together in Pune, Maharashtra, India. Mr. Akhilesh Brahmachari, thank you so much for offering to talk to me about your habits and addictions. I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us your experience.
You're welcome. First of all, I have to understand how you define the word habit. So habit means without which you cannot feel yourself comfortable. So one of the habits which I have found about myself is the drinking tea. So first thing which I do in the morning to get up from my bed and make a cup of tea and drink it. Unless I have that, I cannot feel comfortable with myself.
Can you describe what is the discomfort that you feel?
I mean, discomfort in the sense that something I'm missing. I don't know. It has got into my blood. Doctor have told that, okay, if you're taking a lot of tea, then you develop acidity. If you want to reduce your acidity, then you have to stop the tea. 2-3 days I could manage to stop my tea. But fourth day I say, no, I have to. So this is, I consider that I am addicted or habitual.
Can you describe the feeling you have when you don't have the tea?
I mean, it's very hard to say that. It is something like you miss one of the tooth and your tongue keep going and telling you something is missing. So it is the same with reference to my tea.
That is a beautiful description.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Perhaps you could then describe what it is that you feel when you do take the tea.
Yes, the moment I drink the tea, the taste on my tongue, the contentment, and the fullness, and I feel, yes, I'm okay, I'm all right.
Do you need it to feel awake?
It's not a question of awake or I am sleeping, it is just makes me feel good. It gives me a kind of contentment.
How long have you been drinking tea?
I think I have a restaurant from my father. So we were drinking from the childhood, I think.
Do you remember if you started when you were 3 or 5 or 7 or 10?
I don't remember that, but we used to go whenever we feel hungry, we make tea and drink it. It was all the time in the restaurant. We were family restaurant we were running and we got used to it.
My question would be, if you were feeling hungry, why didn't you eat food instead of drinking tea?
Yeah, I do take food. It is not that I am substituting tea for my food, but there are certain timings which I need to take the tea, like morning tea, then sometime after breakfast, and at least between 3 to 4, that is. And sometime, if it is too longing, then just before going to sleep. Many people say, don't take tea because it will disturb your sleep, but when I take tea, I feel sleep well.
So it's definitely not for the caffeine effect.
I don't know that. I don't know. But it gives me good feeling. So
at least 3 to 4 cups a day.
Yes, 3 and 4 cup of day. And that I have to make. And otherwise, I have to search for at least 10 restaurants to find the tea for my taste.
Can you describe the tea for your taste?
It has to be flavor of the tea and a little bit ginger. And also the sweetness in it. And sometimes cardamom, if it is mixed, then it gives more taste to my tea.
Have you noticed any change in your mood or in the way that your day goes if you don't have your tea?
For example, few days I left it. First day it is harder. Second day is more easy. Third day is half easy, half not easy. Fourth day I always take.
I can't
stop for the day.
So 3 days is your maximum?
Yes, yes, yes.
The tea habit that you're describing, and even the schedule of the tea habit that you're describing, seems to be typically Indian. I mean, it's a very common Indian schedule for having tea. First thing in the morning, a little after breakfast, in the afternoon after the afternoon rest, and then maybe in the evening.
Yeah, I think so. Same.
Can you describe how the culture may have influenced your development of this habit?
Yeah, culture has influenced. Like in Europe, if you go in some families in the evening or lunch, they offer wine. And if you are going to Indian families, the first thing they offer you tea and with that some cookies. So it has a cultural influence and also my family influence.
Would you say that there's a social aspect to having the tea? Like it's part of, you know, being with other people?
Yes. When you get together, then you have a tea. And so because in Indian families, most of the time you are not supposed to give anything else, either sweet and tea or not much coffee. Like South India, they offer coffee. North India, we offer tea.
So, but it's like if you go to somebody's house and you say, well, I don't drink tea, then they're at a loss of what to offer you.
Yeah, they might be surprised because usually people never say no to the tea. Maximum they can say if they have sugar patient, they will say make a tea without sugar. But most of the time I have not seen anybody saying that I don't want tea.
Yes, when you go to an Indian family, either they offer you tea or a cold drink.
Yeah, nowadays the trend is starting. Modern families, in a way, you can say those who are speaking more English and they want to express themselves like a European, American, whatever it is. They offer you a cold drink. But if you go village side, there is totally different. In the village side, they will offer you, if you are summertime, you are coming, they offer you sikanji, they offer you some cold lassi and not tea. It also depends upon time to time, which time and where you are.
Yes, lassi is a cold yogurt drink and shikanjvi is a cold lemon water.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is like that.
It's also a kind of a way that people get together. You say to your friends, oh, I'll meet you and we'll have a cup of tea.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when people get together, they say we'll have a cup of tea.
And if you say, okay, I'll meet you but I won't have any tea, then there's nothing else really.
Usually I have not so far heard that anybody saying that I don't want to have a tea.
That is a new thing for you, that anybody in the world could say, I don't drink tea or I don't want to have a cup of tea.
No, I know that when I meet some European people, they say that I don't drink tea. So it is, but as Indian families and friends, I have not heard so far that anybody is saying no to tea.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add about the tea habit?
I think it is very personal. I found it is difficult to drop it because doctor were saying. And lastly, I didn't drop it. And now I'm feeling my acidity is gone. I am doing my yoga practice. With that, it is taken care of. I have no problem with drinking tea.
Do you think there is any historical or political angle on how the tea habit has come to India? If the tea habit was always here, or did the British bring it, or is there some influence from China? Or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so far I have heard that when the British people were ruling India, they were opening a free places, offering the tea, introducing. And my grandfather, he was saying, usually they were not drinking tea, they were only drinking in the morning chach. Chach means a buttermilk, or milk the cow and drink the milk. That was used to be like in the morning drink, not the tea. Tea has, I'm sure that is an influence from the British.
First the British gave us free tea, and then they started selling it to us.
Right, that's true. That's what happening. Now every families have no milk, no chach, no curd. They have more tea.
And tea is definitely much less nutritious.
Less nutritious, causing acidity, is causing dependence, is not that healthy. Once you get addicted, then you manage somehow to live.
It's like the tobacco company is giving free cigarettes to children and then getting them to buy the cigarettes as adults.
Yeah, it used to be in India. I have seen that people were giving this free bidis. They were selling, please come and have a try this Balak Chap bidi. And they offer free bidi, and then you start buying that Balak Chap bidi. Yeah. Bidi means cigarette. Yes.
Or it's like doctors giving free drug samples, and then after the drug samples are finished, then the patient has to buy them.
I don't know what happens in that alchemy of the body, but something influences physically, mentally, or maybe emotionally. And then you get used to that, and you have no way to come out, and you don't know what to do. Then you keep giving money and taking it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing your experience with your addiction with chai.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. Thank you.
Akhilesh Brahmachari, yoga practitioner and teacher in India.
Dha 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 kita taka thi kita taka tari kita taka ta tari kita gadi gana tari kita taka dheri dheri kita taka te ta dha 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 ta dha. Dha 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 kita taka thi kita taka tari kita taka ta tari kita gadi gana tari kita taka dheri dheri kita taka te ta dha 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 ta dha. Dha 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 kita taka thi kita taka tari kita taka ta tari kita gadi gana tari kita taka dheri dheri kita taka te ta dha 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 ta dha.
Our concluding poem. If I were you and you were me, and the four of us sat down to tea, we sat in a circle and you stood in a line, and we waved out the window and felt we felt fine. Then you started thinking what I had thunk about what you had thought of me. So I hung on a ledge and you swung on a vine, and we climbed all the trees in order to feel taller. We passed each other with silent tears and flying colors.
Neijing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website set up and design, Srinivas Pakkanatti and Dirk Polson. tabla and manjira played by Jayasi, bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez, drum set by G.C. Garcia, compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary, concluding poem written by Jayasi, distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions, found at gypsyjace.net, gypsyjace.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org.